Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, January 30th, 2011, and this is show number 297. Hey, we're inching up on 300 any day now. Well, I'm sure by this time you've figured out that Macworld Expo was this week, and Steve and I were able to attend. Every year the trip has evolved for me, and each year I actually think I enjoy it more. You know, some stuff you go to, it's like, oh, it's always the same, it never changes, you know, blah, 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 I'm tired of it. But as many people have said, it seems to be the people you meet and learn from that makes all the difference in the show. One of the tough things about Macworld Expo is there's so darn much to do. There's an IT conference for those who work in the field of Macintosh. There's the user conference, which is kind of more my speed. There's the featured presentations, and then there's the exhibit hall. Now, you do pay extra for the user conference and the IT conference, but this was the first year we had passes to the user conference, so that was really fun. I got to tell you, I was never bored trying to figure out what to do next. It was more like, I missed that talk Don did on ScreenFlow because I was over here doing this other thing. And I'm still mad about that. I hope he'll just sit down and do it for me one-on-one someday. I've heard a few people say that they didn't find much to see on the show floor, and I think I know why. If you just wandered up and down the aisles using your eyes to judge whether something's interesting, you would have found out that about 20% of the booths had iPhone cases or iPad holders. I thought that was boring, so I skipped over all of that. Then there was a whole music aisle. You can guess what I did there, right? Well, I did actually go over there because the Berklee School of Music was there again, and my brother happens to be a professor there. Yeah, go figure. You know, he got all of the musical talent that I am missing, evidently. So I like to stop by and say hi to the guys there and ask them to say hey to my brother. All right, now we've got maybe 70% of the show floor left. I personally found that if you go up and ask the people to explain their products, they're often enthusiastic and can get you to realize how cool their product actually is. Just looking at the sign, you're just going to go, I don't know what that is. Probably not good. Another trick is to not be wowed by the huge booths. For example, HP was there with a massive front and center booth. They had like 20 employees they chipped in. And there was nobody in their booth. They just walked around it or through it to get to the other side. On the other hand, the tiny little booths, which in some cases are actually four vendors sharing a single, like 30-inch diameter circular table, those were absolutely packed every day, all day. And they often had some of the most interesting things. You can't use this as an absolute rule, though, because my personal favorite vendor, Dexim, had a huge booth. Well, this year, Steve and I were able to take the interviews we did up a real notch. Remember back in November, Donald Burr came on the show and he told us about a wireless microphone setup he got from Audio Technica? It was the Audio Technica ATR-288W remote mic. It sounded pretty cool, so Steve's mom got him one for Christmas. The rig consists of a handheld mic that plugs into a wireless transmitter that I actually wear. Somebody suggested a good spot for it, hanging it on the back of my pants. Then on Steve's end, he has the receiver box that hooks into the hot shoe on the top of his camcorder, and it has a wire to pull the audio in. He also can plug in a set of headphones, so he was able to monitor the audio while we're recording, just in case something goes wrong. Steve also bought me a mic flag, one of those cool boxes, you know, the ones that go on your mic to tell people who you are, you know, like NBC or maybe ABC or possibly Podfeet. Well, anyway, this mic setup really gave us new flexibility in doing our recordings. I was able to get up, right, and close and personal with the person I was interviewing, and yet Steve was able to be far enough back to get a good angle on the product that we were seeing demonstrated. That ability to monitor the audio was a lifesaver, too. On one recording, I forgot to take my backpack off, and it was hitting the cable connection to the transmitter. Steve was able to stop me and tell me we had a problem. There was another side benefit of this whole rig with the mic flag and receiver sitting on top of Steve's camcorder thing. We looked official. We had people move out of our way so we could get our interviews, and a lot of people came up and asked us how we were doing it. Audio Technica got some great advertising out of us this week. Well, I'm going to split the interviews up into two batches. We'll have, six or seven this week, and the other half will be next week. You'll get the audio here, but if you'd rather watch the video, that'll be in the show notes as well. I'll break things up with a dumb question or two so you don't get burned out on interviews. By the way, next week I'm going to talk all about the people and the parties and stuff like that. So for now, let's jump in and hear a couple of interviews. Hi, right now I'm in the Korea Seed booth as instructed by Stefan Lesage that I had to meet Cedrine Lusseau. Lusseau, did I get close?
Lusseau.
Oh, okay, I didn't get anywhere near close. But I'd like you to tell us a little bit about the products that Korea Seed is showing off today.
Yes, at Korea Seed we have several iPhone applications and several for the Mac. For the iPhone we have Prismo for scanning and OCR in 10 languages. And it is for specific for business cards, bills, and regular text.
So this is where you can just hold your iPhone up to a business card, it'll scan it in, it'll do OCR, yes, and tell you what it says.
Yes, indeed. We're going to take a picture of the business cards, then Prismo is going to analyze the card and to detect words on it, and to say, yes, I think this word is a name, this word is an email address, this word is an address, etc.
So it's actually figuring out what goes into what field in a business card.
Yes, indeed. So it will be easier afterwards for saving in the address book, or to send a V-card to your colleagues or friends, or to save on Dropbox and Evernote.
Oh, fantastic. Because I don't like taking cards, just I'd rather have bits every time. Now, you've also got Prismo for the Mac. Now, how does that differ?
It's quite different because it wasn't really made for business cards or for big bills specifically. It was made for documents in general. So you're going to take a picture with, well, an iPhone if you want, or with another camera, with a DSLR camera, for instance, or even with your regular scanner if you are under Snow Leopard. It's going to work. And then you can select the area you are interested in. So you are going to make a square or a rectangle, that's it. And Prismo is going to correct the perspective. And afterwards, you can apply OCR and save the results.
Okay, cool. Now, what are these other applications you have? I see a whole bunch of them up on the display back here.
Yes, we are specialized in image processing in general, but sometimes we go a little bit beyond.
Just have some fun.
Yes, a good example of that is Cuboku. It's the green icon over there. It's a 3D Sudoku, It has nothing to do with the rest, but it's really fun.
And sometimes you just got to have fun, right?
Yes, sometimes we need that, and our customers too. So it's really innovative because that didn't really exist before on the App Store.
Okay. Now, what about Vocalia?
Vocalia is for speech recognition. So it's going to help you search for contacts in your address books, for instance, but without tapping the screen. So we're going to say a name, for instance, Stefan Lesage. And Vocalia is going to look in the address book to find his name, and then you can choose which number you want to call. It's office, it's mobile, home, etc.
Okay, great, because that's not really built in terribly well into the iPhone. There's some of that already in the iPhone, though, right?
Yes, indeed. But, the first time we released Vocalia, it was before voice.
Before they had it.
Yes,
oh, okay.
I did it.
Oh, no, I haven't tested yet. You gave me an NFR code for Movie Stiller, but tell us about that one.
Movie Stiller is for stabilizing movies, so you can record really terrific movies with your iPhone 4. It's really a good quality, but you don't realize, but you are always shaking your hand.
Yeah, for such a little light camera, it's hard to do.
It's really little, but when you see it afterwards, it's annoying. And so you can process it with Movie Stiller to stabilize it.
So Movie Stiller is after the fact?
Yes, it's after the recording of the video.
Yes, that's it. Okay, so how would that differ then from what's in iMovie? Or did you do it before iMovie?
We have something similar on the Mac, indeed. We have another application for stabilizing.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't understand. So Movie Stiller is actually in the iPhone then?
Yes, it's on the iPhone, so you can process it directly on the iPhone. So you are on vacation, for instance, you are going to record a movie, you can process it directly and then upload to YouTube if you want. So directly, you don't need to go back home and you don't need your Mac to do that.
Oh, fantastic. Well, it looks like you have an awful lot of really interesting applications, and I'm glad Stefan told us to meet you.
Yes, we try to make really innovative applications and quite high technology applications. We are really interested in that. So. And we hope you are going to like them.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Alison.
Well, I'm going to break in at the end of each one of these and make sure I repeat the URLs so that you get them. I know it drives me crazy when I hear about a really cool product, but I didn't listen at the beginning of when somebody was telling about it, so I didn't know what it was called or I didn't know where it was from. Prismo for Mac and iPhone are available at creaseed.com. That's CreaCeed.com.
I'm in the Busy Cal, or the Busy Mac booth, I should say, with John Chaffee from Busy Mac. And what do you got to show us today?
Well, we're showing both Busy Cal, a product that we've had for a year or so now, along with Busy To Do, our new to-do list manager for the iPhone.
Now, I'm a big fan of Busy Cal. I think you said the genesis last year was that since they have an updated iCal since 1972, it's time to have a more useful version?
That's right. So it's the iCal Pro, as we call it, for Busy Cal for the desktop. And we actually released a new version, a free update, 1.5, a few months ago of Busy Cal. And that was all about compatibility with the new Mobile Me, which Apple just released. It's a new technology they're using for cloud syncing, using CalDAV, which is a protocol for syncing calendars. And that's what we've been working on for the last 6 months on Busy Cal.
Is that why my calendars are actually syncing properly now? Because I didn't actually know. I'm sure I did the update, but I knew it seems to be working well now.
Yeah, it works much better. We're very happy with it. And what we're really happy about is since Apple is now using an open protocol called CalDAV for their syncing of calendar data, it means we can write clients for the iPhone that sync with Mobile Me, because we couldn't do that before because it was proprietary.
Oh, okay. So that opens it up for us.
To do. So since we developed this technology to sync with CalDAV in BusyCal on the desktop, we took that technology to the iPhone so that we could sync with MobileMe in the cloud from the iPhone.
Okay, excellent. So you've always had to-dos in BusyCal, right? You've had them on the side. But now what can we do? How do we work with the iPhone now?
Okay, so one of the most common questions we get from customers is, how can I get to-dos onto my iPhone? Because the built-in calendar app on the iPhone doesn't support to-dos. Right. So we wanted
There was a good idea.
Yeah. So we wanted to solve that piece first. And that's what we're doing with Busy To Do. And you can see it here. I'm running the iPhone simulator. And what this is doing is it's syncing with my MobileMe account and syncing with BusyCal on my desktop. But you don't have to be using BusyCal on the desktop. You could actually just be using iCal, and it will work with that as well.
Oh, okay, that's kind of nice.
So you can. All that's required is MobileMe. So you have to be using the new MobileMe. So I'll show you how it works. I'm going to create a new to-do on the iPhone, and we'll call it Allison's to-do. And I'm going to give that a due date of tomorrow.
I'm not getting anything done between now and tomorrow. I got news for you, John.
Well, we'll give it a low priority so that we're not too upset if it doesn't get done.
Okay, I can live with that then.
And I can choose one of three calendars to put it on. I mean, you can have as many calendars as you want, but it's basically showing me the calendars on my iPhone that exist on my MobileMe account. So I've got three calendars. Those are the three.
Oh, excellent, excellent.
Okay, so I'll put this on the Project X calendar, and I'll go ahead and click Done. Now, what's going to happen is Busy To Do has already synced with MobileMe automatically, and now Busy Cal is syncing with MobileMe, and you can see that Allison's To Do shows up right here on Saturday. That's the
oh, wow.
one created on the iPhone.
Okay. That was on the network here? You managed to do it that fast?
It went up to the cloud. Yeah, I mean, it went through this network, but it went up to the cloud and it came down. And it's two ways, so I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to add some more notes. I'm adding notes in Busy Cal, and I'm going to change the priority to high.
Telling you, I'm still not doing it.
Now it just synced up with MobileMe.
Okay, there it is.
There it is, right? And now if I do a refresh on the iPhone, Allison's To Do changes. You can see it now has a high priority, and there's a little note icon attached to it. And I can go down here. I can see those notes that I added in BusyCal.
Oh, nice. And it's fast, too.
And if I check it off, so I'll mark it as done here on the phone. It pushes it to the bottom of the list. Again, it syncs with MobileMe. We're going to see Allison's To Do on Saturday move to Friday with a check mark in front of it, so I now have a record of when it was completed. So you actually got that done early, got done today.
Oh man, I'm feeling more productive already.
So that's what this is all about. It's just real simple to-dos that mimic the to-do functionality in iCal and BusyCal and just syncs seamlessly without any manual syncing operations involved.
That's fantastic. So how much does to-dos cost?
99 cents for the next few days.
Well, I don't know. It's kind of steep. Now, they may not see this right away, so they might miss the 99 cents.
It's normally $5, so it's still very cheap.
Oh, yeah, that's a nice price. So I have one confession to make. When I did my BusyCal review, I don't like to say everything nice about a product, so I always have to find something to pick on. And I said, you know, this weather stuff on here and phases of the moon, that's stupid. I don't need that. I look at that all the time. I do. I sit there going, ooh, look, it's going to rain tomorrow. I swear, I do look at it. I'm still not sure I need the phases of the moon, but I do at it.
It's addicting. Well, the funny thing about the phases of the moon, in fact, I can remember the night of the 19th, I didn't sleep very well that night, and I've discovered now that it's on those full moons when I have a hard time sleeping for some reason.
Oh, now that's interesting.
Or something.
Now, I did also hear, by the way, that January 17th is the most depressing day of the year.
It
happens to be when all the bills come due from Christmas,
and
it's a Monday. You know, you've had a bunch of Mondays, and your W-2 just came, like that. All right, well, thanks a lot for spending the time with us again, John. Love your products. Great
thanks
stuff.
A lot, Allison. Good to see you.
Like I said in the interview, I'm a big fan of BusyCal and BusySync, so I'll be giving Busy To-Do a try, that's for sure. I do confess that I'm not big on to-do lists. I keep trying them, but I find that I only do the ones that are on yellow sticky notes right in my way, maybe on my desk or my keyboard or something like that. There's always hope, though, that we will find the one to-do application that changes our behavior. I don't care what Robert Lockman says. He says people never change, but I gotta keep having hope, don't I? Busy To-Do is available from BusyMac.com. For some reason, my favorite vendor, ScreenSteps, was not at Macworld. An oversight on their part, to be sure. Heck, I probably could have staffed the booth for a while for them, don't you think? Don't think for a minute that I went the whole 3 days without mentioning them, though. I was talking to someone, I think it was actually Rod Roddenberry, about how we're all so much more patient with other people than we are with our own relatives. He said he looks stuff up on the web for them and points them to the great tutorials that are online so he doesn't have to figure it out for them. I told him that's one of the reasons I love to use ScreenSteps, and I told him about my father-in-law's notebook of tutorials that I've made for him. I'm sure Rod really appreciated getting a ScreenSteps ad on the escalator as we went down to the show floor. In any case, rather than explain the same thing over and over again to your relatives, coworkers, or customers, consider getting a copy of ScreenSteps from ScreenSteps.com. Be sure to use my coupon code NOSILLA, that's my name spelled backwards, in all capital letters for 25% off the purchase price of the standard or pro version.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions. Dumb questions.
How do I? What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Hugo Poon sent in our dumb question for us today. He says, maybe this isn't dumb enough, but I've been wondering for a long time, what's all this fuss about IPv6? Well, I wrote back to him and I suggested this one would be far better if it waited till Bart got back, but he encouraged me to give it my best shot on my own. I do understand it at the most basic level, but if we want real depth, we would need adult supervision. The easiest way to explain the problem is to compare it to phone numbers. It used to be in the old days you had a home phone, and that served all of your family's needs. If you were dialing between counties or between two states, you had to dial the area code and the phone number, all 10 digits. But if you were within a big city, you only had to dial the 7-digit number. Then you got a pager. Then you got a fax machine. Then you got a cell phone. And so did everyone else in your house. In the city of Los Angeles, they actually had to start breaking the city up into separate area codes because there were simply not enough numbers for all of the devices. Finally, they did an overlay area code system, which means we all have to dial 10 digits all the time. Well, the same kind of thing is happening with internet addresses, also called IP or Internet Protocol addresses. Every device on the internet has an IP address. When they first started putting computers on the network in 1981, they used a spec called IPv4 or Internet Protocol version 4. In this spec, every device that went on the network got a unique IP address, which was four sets of numbers separated by a decimal point, like 192.168.1.1, except never that one. Anyway, that worked swell when only companies had computers. Still worked okay when we got computers in our houses, but then the people who worry such things got nervous when we all started getting multiple computers in our homes. They were relieved when we started buying routers in our homes because that meant the router itself had the IP address, but each computer inside our home network didn't have an external IP address. Instead, they were doled out internal addresses by the router using network address translation. Okay, hope you guys are still with me. Fast forward to today, when just about every device you carry has a connection to the internet. I carry three devices, my iPhone, BlackBerry, and iPad, in my purse. Hey, wait a minute. No, I carry the MiFi too, so it's actually four devices. And that's not even counting the connections I have at home and at work.
This explosion of internet-connected devices is again causing those in charge of worrying to furrow the little brows that we will run out of numbers if we stick to the IPv4 scheme. Another factor that helps them become scarce, the numbers, not the people who worry about it, is that they dole out blocks of numbers to ISPs and other groups. So while each group may have some spare, they aren't all in a pile together where you can see how many spare there really are. With IPv4, we have 4 billion numbers available to us, but we're quickly running out and the need is not slowing down. So back in 1998, that's what, 13 years ago? I'm not good at math. I'll keep an eye on the chat room to see if Katie corrects me or not. A group called Internet Engineering Task Force created a new spec. They called it IPv6. Instead of the 4 billion available numbers, IPv6 supports 3.4 times 10 to the 38 addresses, otherwise known as 5 times 10 to the 28th addresses for each of the 6.8 billion people alive today. I think that's probably good for a couple of years, don't you think? Now, what I don't understand myself is what it takes to actually move the world from IPv4 over to IPv6. Since they've been worrying about this for such a long time, they have been making our routers IPv6 capable, but evidently it's a rather big effort to switch everything over. I did hear the other day that a group of ISPs had agreed to do a temporary switchover. I don't know if they were just going to do it for a couple hours or a few minutes, but they just wanted to participate and try to see how big of a deal this was going to be and to discover problems on a smaller-ish scale than the whole world at once. The good news is that IPv6 and IPv4 can peacefully coexist, but that'll require intermediary gateways to allow devices using the different protocols to actually talk to each other. I have a feeling because they can coexist, we're going to be dealing with this topic for decades to come. If you want to learn more about this topic, I put a link in the show notes to the exhaustive article on IPv6 in Wikipedia. Well, let's listen in on a few more interviews. I'm in the AppyGo booth with Jim Norman today, and you're going to tell us about Corculus.
Absolutely, absolutely. Corculus is a digital corkboard that runs on the iPad. We've had it out on the store for just about a year. This is a place you can visually do some storyboarding. You can put your photos. You can put labels with those photos. Here's a photo that one of our guys took last year at Macworld down at the Bay Bridge. You can actually zoom in on any photo by double-clicking it and then actually seeing that photo. So you could do a lesson plan on this. You know,
so kind of a storyboarding application?
Absolutely.
So show us how you add things to the Corculus board.
So to add to the Corculus board, you would open the desk drawer here.
Oh, and then that's pretty.
And then from that, drag out a photo and then pick from your photo library a photo. And on this iPad, I only have one photo, and that's our company logo.
That's a great photo. Yeah. Let's see a post-it note next. Can I do one?
Absolutely.
Oh, that's awesome. Wait, I want it to be pink. That's for Elaine Giles right there.
And then you can change the font or the size of the font in that post-it note. So if I can get it to edit here, we can put a note in.
That is really cool. And then do you have any exports from this, or is it just a way to visualize while you're in it?
No, we can't export this. So say you have a board that you put together for a colleague. You can select that board by selecting the stuff you want to send, come up to export and send that via an email, and it'll take a picture of what you've selected or the whole board.
Oh, that's awesome. So someone else would have to have Corculus on their end, right?
That's correct. Or if I sent a photo, it would be a JPEG or a PNG file that gets
sent. But so you can share your storyboarding ideas.
Yes.
Yeah, I guess it wouldn't make sense to go out like as a TXT or a CSV or anything. That wouldn't make any sense. It'd have to stay in this kind of format to make sense.
Right. You'd want to see the visual aspect of it to be the storyboard.
Now, you also have a task managing program?
We do.
Why don't you bring that up?
Okay. Our task management app is called To-Do. It manages tasks on a daily basis. You can create those tasks to repeat periodically, every day, every 2 days, every third day of the month, whatever.
Like pay the bills?
Yes, pay the bills. It doesn't pay the bills for you. It just reminds you to pay the bills.
All right. Well, that's close enough. Now, is it all stuck in the iPad, or does it sync with something?
The to-do data syncs with a website called To-Do Online.
Okay. So, and then can you get to it from there? Or do you go to the website, or what do you do next?
Yes, you can take your Safari browser, go to the website, log in there, manage your to-do items right there as well.
I like that, because there's times you're not with your Mac or you're not with your iPad. Now, does it also sync to the Mac?
It does. We have a program called Apigo Sync, and that comes down to the Mac and synchronizes with iCal.
All right, so how much is To-Do?
To-Do is $4.99 in the App Store today.
Gotta love it, gotta love it. And do you get that syncing program for free?
The syncing program is for free.
Okay, and how much is Corculus?
Corculus is $4.99 as well in the App Store.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much, Jim. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. I should mention, we have To-Do on the iPhone as well, and you can synchronize there.
Oh, yeah. Good point. Thank you.
If you're not carrying this in your pocket, you can probably get your iPhone in your pocket.
That's what I got a purse for.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you for stopping by.
You know, it might be fun to do a fly-off between Apigo's To-Do Online against BusyMac's Busy To-Do. More fun than actually getting my action items done, of course. Corculus and To-Do Online are available from apigo.com. That's APPIGO.
I'm here in the Dexon booth with Patrick Tarpey, and he's going to tell us about some pretty cool products here. This is the thing I've been really excited to come talk to somebody about.
Yeah, thanks, Allison. This is Dexon's Visible G charger. Basically reduces your standby power by about 85% by automatically shutting down when your device is fully charged, so it stops pulling what you might call phantom power from the wall. What you're seeing here is the actual current being put into the iPhone. It starts to slow down at about 65% and then again 90%, and then it'll shut down completely at 100% charged.
I know that's a gimmick, but I love it. It's awesome just to give you that visual that, you know, you're almost full and then that it's not wasting power.
Right, exactly. And the wire itself is actually EL, which is electroluminescent wire covered in phosphorus. So this is the actual current being
pulled. Oh, it really is. It's not a gimmick. It's real.
No gimmicks.
Well, I mean, maybe a gimmick to show it to us, but to show us why not.
Right, exactly.
So now I was talking to some people last night that didn't realize that having all these things plugged in was wasting power. I understand even if you didn't have the iPhone plugged into a charger, it's already sucking power normally?
Right. It is slowly, but it is pulling more power. So even
you add up the 85 things you have in your house, it's not so slow.
Coffee
right?
makers, you name it. So, I started thinking about it too, and it's scary.
Yeah. So how much does a charger like that cost?
It's going to be just under $40, $39.90. Should be available in retail later this month, actually.
Oh, excellent. Available through your website or other places too?
Yeah, Dexon.net will be the best place to go, and then we expect Amazon as well.
All right, gotta love Amazon, affiliate link.
Yeah, great.
What else do you have to show us today?
Another new item here is the Dexon's P-Flip foldable solar power for the iPhone. Now there's a version that's compatible with all different iPhones, but basically acts as a dock and a power station in one, so you can watch your videos vertically or horizontally like that at your desktop. You can use it as a nightstand, and then it obviously flips and folds nicely to go into your pocket, your purse, your briefcase, but also has these two solar panels. So if you're camping, hiking at the beach, you can pick up that solar charge.
Heck, you could have it sitting on your dash and charge it while you're driving, right?
Exactly. Now, we have noticed that certain factors like window tint can slow down the charge time.
That makes sense. So how long does it take to charge up an iPhone from dead?
From dead with natural sunlight, about 15 hours, but you can also charge and sync your data with this micro USB in quick as an hour and a half, almost 2 hours.
I don't understand. Where's the power coming from if you use a micro USB?
So there's actually a built-in 2,000 milliamp battery in here as well.
No way!
The solar panels really act as kind of just a bonus for if you are in that emergency situation. So it's not only solar powered. So there is a built-in battery, pretty strong one too as well.
That is amazing. I love this. Well, how much is that going to cost?
$79.90. This is available now at Amazon.
Okay, how many milliamp hours did you say?
2,000.
Oh, that's a lot. That is fantastic. What is that thing called?
This is the P-Flip Foldable Solar Power from Dexon.
All right, very cool. Anything else you wanted to show us here? I'm loving this. You can keep going if you got more.
Yeah, I got one more brand new item here I'm going to show it to you. It's actually over here. Another pretty strong portable battery pack that kind of multifunctional. So 2,000 milliamps in here. As you can see, it kind of acts as a case and a portable battery pack. But also has this built-in kickstand for watching video and an on and off power switch as well, so you can control when you need that power for at a trade show or wherever. And then if you're at your desk, or you can watch your movies like that as well.
And how much does this one cost?
$69.90.
Okay, so that's called the Super Juice?
The Super Juice power case, yep.
Wow, those are cool. It comes in white and black.
Yep.
And it looks like, we got a matte finish. And I love the feel of the matte finish.
I like the black a little bit better,
I just
too.
Like to touch it. But, you know, if you've been looking for that white iPhone, maybe that's what you need, right?
Exactly.
That's awesome. Well, this is fantastic. I actually think this is my favorite thing I've seen so far here. This is really cool.
We've won the award, done a bit.
Yeah, the number one Podfeet Award so far.
Okay. There's a full day left here, so I won't think too highly, but thank you.
All right. Well, we'll see how it comes out in the end. All right, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
The two products Patrick showed me from Dexim might have been the coolest things I saw at the whole show. Well, I've known forever that leaving every charger plugged in all over my house was a bad idea energy-wise. It's far too impractical to run around plugging and unplugging them. How much more practical to just have the darn charger stop drawing current all by itself? And add in the coolness of the current flow showing as light, that makes it even better using the visible green wall charger. Can't wait to test out the P-Flip solar charger case for the iPhone. Since I live around so much sunlight, maybe I could save some electricity right there. The visible green wall charger and the P-Flip foldable solar power are available from Dexim.net. That's Dexim.net. Well, I'm standing in the SellYourMac.com booth with Chris Ladenberger. Nice to meet you today, Chris.
Nice to meet you, too.
All right, what are you guys hawking at this show?
Basically, what we do is we buy and sell used Apple gear. So if you have an iPod, iPhone, MacBook, iPad, anything like that, you can submit a request through our website, and we'll give you a free hassle-free quote. And basically, what you do is you send in your Mac to us, and once we receive and test it, we'll send you a check or PayPal payment.
So do you send a box and the whole thing?
We just send a prepaid FedEx label. You have to take care of the box yourself, but the label is all taken care of, so you don't have to worry about paying for shipping.
Oh, that's nice. I hate going to the post office and dealing with that whole thing. That's a pain.
Exactly. No standing in line. You just tape the label on and drop it off at FedEx, and you're good to go.
All right, so we've got a first-gen MacBook Air we need to sell. Why would we sell through you versus Craigslist or something?
Well, basically, what our company does is you avoid the hassle of dealing with customers, scammers. You know, Craigslist, there's a lot of people that are trying to scam you and whatnot.
And I don't like people.
Well, there you go. If you don't like to deal with people, then you can just go through our website and you only deal with one person. That would be me, and I'll get you taken care of. No hassles or anything like that.
So what do you do with the used equipment when you get it? Do you resell it?
Yes, we resell it. What we'll do is we'll wipe all the previous data off there, do any kind of upgrades that we feel necessary, and then we'll reload the operating system on all the software and then resell it.
So how many times do you wipe it? Do you do the FBI level wipe or just erase and reformat?
If somebody wants to do a 3-pass or a 7-pass format, we'll certainly do that for you, but typically we just do a standard format.
Okay, so if you've got sensitive data, you ought to scrape it yourself first.
Sure, or you can tell us if you want to do multiple pass, we can certainly do that too.
There you go. So now, why do you guys have a giant iPhone costume over here? I don't know if you can see that there.
Well, the giant iPhone costume is actually a 40-inch LED TV, and it's just a great promotional tool. We have an animation of our company that we have on there, as well as a bunch of funny pictures. So it's just a fun thing
catches
to have.
Catches attention, right.
Exactly.
There you go. That's what it's all about. Well, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, Chris. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you.
I'm really excited about the Sell Your Mac guys because I'm just too darn lazy to use services like Craigslist to sell my devices. I'm too lazy to even know that there's scammers out there because I've never even done it. I've been pretty lucky that if I procrastinate long enough, someone in my life ends up buying something off of me. Steve is pretty sure, though, that he's going to sell his old MacBook Air using SellYourMac.com, and I still have Kyle's 3GS laying around since he got his iPhone 4. Perhaps we'll sell that there, too. You can sell your Apple products at SellYourMac.com. Well, I'm with the Crazy Glyph people. Studio Neat, apparently, is the name of the company.
Yeah.
And I'm with Thomas Gerhardt and Daniel Provost. Nice to meet you guys.
Nice to meet you.
So tell us about the Glyph. I've seen your videos, and I love it. But for anybody who hasn't already seen it, tell us about it.
The Glyph is just a little piece of plastic that you can use to mount your iPhone onto a tripod. It's really snug, which is nice. And then you can also use it as a stand. So that's really my favorite part in some ways because it's super versatile. You can put it however you want on here. It's kind of like your little buddy that you can walk around with all day.
But it's not some giant thing that you got to carry in your pocket, right?
Yeah, it's just like a little thing. Very small, very light, kind of soft rubber. So nice and friendly and really useful. That's my favorite thing.
Now, you guys did an interesting thing the way you guys got your business started, right? Tell the audience about what you guys did.
So, you know, Dan and I, it's just Dan and I, and...
this is the whole thing right here.
This is everything. We get in a car wreck, it's over. We had this idea, but we didn't have any money. So we went to Kickstarter, which is like an online crowdsourcing fundraising platform. And we ended up raising some money on the internet to like get this thing started.
So the thing you guys needed was money to be able to fund having the mold made and that sort of
thing,
right?
Yeah, so this is injection molded. And so the mold to make this is like the price of a car, basically. So it takes a lot of upfront money, but after that you can make a lot of them very quickly. We needed kind of this upfront capital to make the mold, and we got that money. And so now we're kind of have been kickstarted, and we're...
You had people pledge, right? Is they pledged in and said how much money they're willing to give?
Or? Yeah, I mean, it was essentially, the way we set it up was essentially a pre-order for the thing. So it's saying, you know, if you pledge this amount, then you'll get one when we make it. So they're kind of buying in advance, basically.
Yeah, it was only, how much was it? I forget.
$20.
$20. Yeah. So $20 you could buy into this idea, just like, you guys sold it. Like, I mean, the product is cool, but I think you guys are really the selling factor in it, is you were so fun just going, hey, we want to do this. It's really neat. Give us $20. And everybody went, okay. Now, how much money did you have to get to be able to start it?
Well, we thought we needed about 10 grand, but that was when we were thinking we would make like 500 of them. So once it kind of ballooned up, then it was probably closer to, I don't know,
$70,000. But we ended up, so we had a goal of $10,000 on Kickstarter, but we ended up raising like $130,000.
Oh my gosh, are you serious?
Yeah, absolutely insane. So that kind of blew us out of the water. But because of that, you know, we had like 5,000 pre-orders. So
you had to actually make them.
Yeah, we had to make them, and then we had to, you know, ship those off to people. So that ends up costing a lot of money. So, it kind of got into this huge balloon state. But now we have an online store, and we're kind of riding the wave.
Now you're just cruising on it, right? What's your next big idea?
Well, we...
you're not a one-hit wonder,
no,
are you?
Hopefully not. Yeah, we're working on our next thing, so we'll see if it works or not.
Yeah.
All right, very cool. So are you selling them here for $20?
Yeah, we're selling them for $18 again.
$18. Yeah. Ooh, you got it going on. Plus, you have some neat artwork there. Did you see their art?
Yeah, we just stuck them up. We had to do something.
Yeah.
All right, that's awesome. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. That's awesome.
Talking to these guys was a real treat. I loved their video when they were first asking for donations. I put a link to it in the show notes so you can see that too. They're hysterical, so energetic and fun. I can see why they're so successful. They also came up with a really cool product idea that might have something to do with it. Anyway, you can find the Glyph at theglyph.com. That's theglif.com. Well, that's going to wind it up for all of the product reviews, but we have a guest today for the Honda Bob commercial. I hope you enjoy this.
Hello. This is Honda Bob, and this is my 200th commercial on Allison's show. I've been in business for over 30 years, and the last 4 years on Allison's show has opened up a new avenue for attracting new customers. Allison certainly has a varied assortment of listeners, some of which have contributed to making these commercials. Every commercial is different from the last, and every one of them are highly appreciated. Just last week, I got the privilege of meeting Katie Floyd from Florida. And a couple of years ago, I met Justin and Dave from MacCrack.com when they were on vacation from Ireland. It's always fun to meet someone who is an avid listener of Allison's podcast. She does have a way with words. She is constantly trying to get me to go full on with Mac computers. I do have an iPhone 4 with a credit card scanner and an iPad, but my laptop and desktop are still Windows PCs. I think the reason for this is that I have a customer in San Jose who keeps giving me his outdated computers, which are usually less than 6 months old. All it cost me is a couple of services on his Honda cars. The desktop PC I got is an IBM Lenovo desktop that has two terabyte hard drives running at 2 gigahertz with 6 gigabytes of internal memory. He set up another 2 terabyte hard drive running anytime backup as well, all supported by an uninterruptible power supply. No more worries about system crashes. The IBM ThinkPad laptop he gave me last year was recently upgraded to Windows 7 Professional, a 200 gigabyte hard drive, and 4 gigabytes of internal memory running at 2 gigahertz as well. This laptop accompanies me everywhere. I have installed the latest map system from Microsoft, as well as Microsoft Outlook, to keep me on time and informed. My extensive database of customer vehicle information is managed by a program called InfoSelect. A Mac computer system at this time is just not necessary. Sorry, Allison, but keep trying. I tend to buy the latest automotive technology for my business. Like Allison said, I don't like to be late for any scheduled appointment. My latest service vehicle is a 2011 Honda Pilot EX, fully outfitted with tools and equipment for servicing your car at your location and your convenience. Anyway, about my business, you can reach me at area code 562-531-2321, or you can visit my very informative website at hdabob.com. There, you can learn all the inner workings of your car, even if it isn't a Honda or an Acura. My website also has some interesting travel stories of my experiences of driving around Southern California for the last 30 years or so. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide.
Well, we're going to get Bob over to a Mac someday, aren't we? Well, I'll keep working on you, Bob. My first impression when I read through the security updates on us-cert.gov, as Bart has taught me, was that there wasn't much to chat about. There was an update to Opera, which you should install if you're an Opera user because it is a security update. There's a vulnerability in Windows for which there's no patch anyway. Then there was an update to RealPlayer, but I figure, you know, hardly anyone's actually using RealPlayer these days, so it's probably not that big of a deal. I asked Bart about it, and he explained that with these kinds of vulnerabilities, simply having a vulnerable media player installed can cause you trouble even if you don't use it. They trick you into going to a web page you shouldn't visit, and then the player vulnerability is exploited. You don't have to open the player, so you can just have it sitting on your hard drive, and you're going to be in trouble. By the way, it's not just RealPlayer, but any media player, if not kept up to date, can make you vulnerable in this way. So, do a scan of your hard drive. If you find RealPlayer and you haven't got a need for it, uninstall it. Or if you still do use it, be sure to update. By the way, at Macworld, I met a woman named Linda, who I'd met up with last year, and she told me how much she misses Bart's security information. She sort of patted me on my addled little brain with a, "We know you try, Allison," tone of voice, telling me it's not the same as getting the in-depth analysis from Bart. I suggested that she listen to Security Now with Steve Gibson. She said, "I already do, but that I get even more from Bart." Yet another reason Bart needs to get better. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond. And let's see, this week, I think it's Chit Chat Across the County again, this time with Donald Burr of Otaku No Podcast. How are you, Donald?
Pretty good. How are you?
We are in the same county or close by anyway, I think, aren't we?
Close enough, yeah.
Close enough. Chit Chat Across LA, maybe.
There you go.
Well, I wanted to get you on the show because you've been doing some presentations at various shows lately, and one of them was on conference photography. And this is kind of cheating because I'm getting to talk to you before I go to Macworld, so I'm going to be better at it than everybody else, but everybody else is going to hear about it after Macworld. So I have ulterior motives in having you on the show today.
There you go.
Now, where all have you given this presentation?
Well, I've been at... Over the past year, I've been at several anime conventions. The biggest one is Anime Expo, which was this past July in L.A. That's kind of the probably the biggest anime convention in the country. I've also been to a couple of smaller conventions in L.A. and up in San Jose.
Oh, okay. All right. So you've been on the world tour telling people how to do this, huh?
It's something like that, yeah.
That's a lot of fun. So where do you want to start us off?
Well, let's start with defining the problem, as you always do.
Yay.
The three typical scenarios that you see at anime conventions, but this also applies to other conventions as well as, you know, school plays, lectures, well, almost any public event, really.
Okay.
So your first situation is outdoors.
Oh, now that's unusual. I don't think I've ever been to a conference that had an outdoor component.
Well, you know, you might have like an outdoor lecture or like a speech or something, you know, like a political rally or something.
Sure.
Your second situation is indoors in your typical conference room, you know, expo floor. And your final situation is your theater setting, you know, like a Steve Note or something like that.
And that's the one I really need help with. I've managed to take so many dreadful pictures in theaters.
Yes. And unfortunately, that is the most challenging of the three.
So should we start with outdoors then?
Let's start with outdoors. typically you see a lot of light, and you might think, this is great. Yes, it is, but it also isn't. The problem is the light is bright, and it's very, very directional, which means it casts nasty, harsh shadows.
Okay.
So the solution to this one is simple. Take them out of the under a shade, under a tree, but in the shadow of a building, something like that. Obviously, if you're like, you know, a reporter taking a picture of like a, you know, a speech or something, you can't exactly say, could you move over there, please?
That's what I was trying to picture, exactly what you thought we'd do there.
But if you're, you know, if you have control over the situation, yeah, take them under the shade. That's literally what the top, you know, press photographers do, you know, when they're, you know, taking shots of people under the shade. If you have an assistant, or you just kind of grab somebody off the, you know, off the street, and you have this nifty thing called a reflector. They're like these little pop-up things that, you know, they like the you know, the car sunshade.
Oh, car window things, kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
Right,
it's
right.
It's basically like a translucent white piece of fabric that does a great job of reflecting light. So what you do is you put that in, you know, opposite of where the sun is, so it kind of fills in the shadows of the person.
Oh, okay. So now, this is when you definitely have real control of the situation, right?
Exactly, yes. But if you're taking a close-up of someone, it's even easier. Just have them hold a piece of white paper out of frame.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. So something big enough white, I suppose, right?
Right. Right. It's like you're taking a picture for someone's face just to have them hold a sheet of paper out from, you know, outside the frame.
Now, don't you feel funny making people wait around while you figure this stuff out, while you get it set up? That's what I always feel like. I'm imposing on their time, and I ought to do it as quickly as possible.
Well, you know, you figure that, you know, they want the best possible picture of themselves, so, you know.
That's true. I never thought about that.
Yeah.
I always think it's just for me, but I suppose they want to look good.
There you go. Now, if it happens to be a cloudy day, you're in luck, because the clouds really do a great job of softening the light. The only problem, though, is nobody likes to see a cloudy sky. Mm. So the solution to that is minimize the sky. Okay. Shoot down on them from an angle, you know, just so that you minimize the amount of sky visible, or like put them against a wall, or, you know, something like, basically just minimize the sky.
Okay.
I mean, it sounds totally obvious, but, you know, a lot of people just don't kind of think that way, you know?
Right, right. You know, I'll tell you one thing, there is an advantage, maybe men aren't as vain to think about this, but for women, we don't like to be filmed from below at all because it makes our chin look bad. But if you film us from above, your neck stretches out and your chin looks much better.
Right.
So looking down on somebody is probably a good way to go.
Now, and finally, the last thing you can do is use pop-up flash.
Not the pop-up flash,
no,
right? An external flash?
Fill-in flash. Thank you. Okay. That was the word I was looking for. Some cameras have an explicit setting for fill-in flash, but if yours doesn't, just, you know, set your flash to on. And it might be, you know, the trick is to get it so that it fills in the shadows but doesn't blow out the person. So if your flash has a setting for something called flash exposure compensation, that basically dials down the power of the flash.
Oh.
Otherwise, just kind of step away from the person a little bit.
Now, that I haven't seen. I do like the effect of a fill flash. It's kind of freaky looking sometimes. Like you get a picture of someone in front of a sunset, but they're not in silhouette, and your eye's like, wait a minute, that can't be what it looked like.
Right.
But you have flash compensation, huh? I should go look for that.
Yes. Some cameras call it FEC. They don't make it obvious, you know.
Okay. I should look for that. I haven't ever seen it, so the Nikon D40 might not have that. Might be for fancy pants cameras.
Right. All right. Well, that about does it for outdoors.
Oh, okay, good.
Let's move.
I don't have too much outdoor opportunity, at least for that. But in regular life, I do.
Right.
Okay.
Now let's move indoors. You're in a conference room, you know, you're watching someone's presentation, or let's say you're running around the expo floor.
Yes.
You run into, you know, someone cool, like, you know, Sal Segoyan or somebody cool. You want to take their picture with them.
Uh-huh.
The problem with indoors is the light. First of all, there's not very much of it compared to outdoors. And second of all, it's of different types. You could have incandescent, you could have fluorescent, or even worse, a combination of both. And this really means you have to watch your white balance.
So do you actually spend time fiddling around with white balance, or do you just go, I'll just fix it over in Photoshop, I'll shoot in RAW?
You know, Of course, shooting in RAW does offer you the most flexibility in terms of fixing things later. You can sort of do it in JPEG, but sometimes you get things where, like, you know, it turns people's skin green or something.
Not exactly ideal.
Unless you're, like, taking pictures of, you know, someone cosplaying as an alien or something, you know.
Intentionally that way.
Yeah.
So you like to have it right to start with?
I try to get it right in camera, you know, as much as possible. So, like, you know, if I know, you know, I take some test shots, you know, see what looks close enough. And here's the thing, when you're going back later to edit white balance, you know, you could go the whole gray card route, but you don't have to. Just find someone with, like, a white shirt or, like, you know, someone with a white piece of paper and just, you know, white balance off of that.
So I only learned last week how to actually do that. I'd always heard people talking about that, but I just found out last week how to actually execute that maneuver, and now I want to go use it. But, man, that's like 10 minutes of me fooling around with that. I don't know who's going to hang around waiting for me to do that.
Again, you know.
Maybe do it once for the conference floor, the show floor, that kind of thing.
The nice thing is you only have to do it once, and any other pictures you take in the same lighting conditions, you can use the lovely lift and stamp tool in Aperture or pretty much any other photo editing program out there. You know, take the adjustments you did from one picture and, you know, slap them onto all the other ones you take there.
Right, right. You mostly do it using a DSLR, or are you using a point and shoot when you're shooting these kind of photographs?
Yeah, mostly DSLR.
So are you carrying around 15 lenses and a giant camera bag and a tripod and smacking into everybody as you walk down the hall? Or that's how I do it.
Actually, I only carry two lenses typically. I usually have the standard, you know, 18 to 55, which is sort of the standard kit
catch-all
range.
Right.
Right. And then I've got my 70 to 200 zoom.
Oh, now I've gone back and forth on this, whether to carry the 50 millimeter or whatever mine is under, you know, dividing by three and multiplying by five and dividing by my mother's maiden name, 35 millimeter. I don't know what it is. One day I'm going to make Bart really explain that to me. But I've thought about carrying that, but it seems so inflexible because you got to get right up on stuff to do anything with it.
Yeah. You know, prime lenses are great because, you know, they do have they're, you know, better, easier to build than zoom. So you typically get better image quality. But yeah, you have that whole you have to zoom with your feet thing, which a lot of times you can't do, you know.
Right. Right. So you carry both the 18-55, 55-200. That's maybe that's what I'll do. I went back and forth, back and forth usually. So.
Mm-hmm. So again, getting back to indoors, you know, you typically don't have the best seating. You know, maybe you're back in row 20 or something. Mm-hmm. If it's a really important event to you, you know, try to get there early, get the best seat. But again, you know, it's just a matter. Really, when you're indoors, the name of the game is to keep it steady because, you know, your light isn't as good. So that means your camera has to keep the shutter open longer in order to get the proper exposure. So, of course, the longer your shutter is open, the more chance of getting that nasty, blurry camera shake thing going on.
But even if I'm not camera shaking, if I'm perfectly still, the person I'm taking the picture of is always blurry because they moved.
Right. And
so what do I do about that?
That is you have to make sure that you have a fast enough shutter speed because, again, the longer your shutter is open, if the person moves, then, you know, they're blurry, even if you're steady.
Right.
So typically, usually for shutter speeds, about anything 1/60th or faster is enough to, you know, freeze motion.
So would you go shutter priority in that kind of a situation?
In that case, yes.
So set it to 60, for example, and then the aperture is going to open up as wide as it can.
Right. And in that case, you know, it's best to have a lens, what we call a fast lens.
You know, yeah, I don't have a fast lens. Mine are like f4.5, I think, something like that.
My 18 to 55 is it's a 17 to 50, which is what I normally use, is a f2.8. So, you know,
that's nice. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not the kit lens.
No, it's not. It's sort of the upgrade to the kit lens. And the trick for that, for me, for that is to buy off-brand. The Canon, I'm a Canon shooter. The Canon 17-55 f2.8 is like over $1,000. I went with the third-party lens, a Tamron lens, which is actually extremely well-reviewed. That one only cost me like, what, $450 or so?
Wow, that's still a lot of money.
It's still a lot of money, but, you know, for what you get, it's a really amazing deal.
Yeah, yeah. So with my slower lens, though, I think you said something in here about messing around with the ISO can help me as well.
Yes, ISO. That is the wonderful thing that digital cameras brought to the table, in that we can dynamically change the ISO, or in other words, the sensitivity to light of the sensor. Back in the old film days, you'd have to load your camera with whatever sensitivity of film that you're depending on shooting, like, you know, ISO 100 for daytime or ISO 400 for, like, in a room, really well lit room. And,
right.
And, you know, you shoot, like, say you only shoot 10 pictures outdoors and you go inside, well, you have to change film and you forfeit the rest of your roll. So now we're in digital.
It was also really grainy, too.
Yeah. And actually, we still have that problem, unfortunately. But in terms of digital, we can now dynamically change the ISO from shot to shot, which is wonderful. And most, you know, pretty much any modern DSLR, anything made in the past few years, you can push 800, 600, 1600, maybe even 3200 ISO. And as you mentioned before, unfortunately, the higher you go, the more noise you bring to the table. With the modern DSLRs, the noise is pretty well controlled, though. I mean, I shoot regularly at ISO 1600, and I don't notice any, you know, noticeable noise in the picture.
Yeah, I think it's a lot better than it was on film. And I remember going to 800 film, and it was just like there was no point in even using it. It was just awful. It's
like, looks like, you know, random, like, television static, you know?
Right, right. Or like you put it through a screen or something.
Right. Now, if you do have to push your ISO a little bit past your comfort point and you do get some noise, all hope is not lost. We have some awesome image processing software these days that just does a fantastic job of removing noise. A couple weeks ago on MacBreak Weekly, Andy Ignatko recommended a program that I honestly have never heard of. It's called Neat Image. It does a fantastic job. And you might be thinking, oh, it's a plugin. It must cost over $9,000. No, I think it's only $40.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's awesome software.
Oh, it looks like it's for Windows and for Mac, too. Look at that. Oh, so it's a plugin for Photoshop.
Photoshop and
Aperture.
Yes.
Nice.
Good stuff. Huh. Yeah, it's a fantastic program.
Sorry, just keep talking. I'm going to be reading this article while you're talking.
Sure. No. So, you know, like I said, when you're indoors, the real name of the game is to keep your camera as steady as possible. And, you know, there are many tricks to do this. The most obvious one, which still a lot of people, you know, in the heat of the moment may not think of, use your environment. Find a post to lean against, find a railing to lean your camera lens against, if the chair in front of you is empty, you know, use it to prop your elbow up or something. Or heck, I've even asked people if I could prop a lens on their shoulder.
And do they say yes?
No. Yeah. Some have.
A couple of them smack you, but you know, it's worth the risk, right?
There you go. You know, if you're in the back, you know, standing against the back wall, you know, basically anything to keep your camera steady. And, you know, our instinct normally is to hold our arms out while taking pictures. No, the best way to do it is kind of compress your arms against your chest. And again, you know, it's kind of hard to describe in audio, but basically just, you know, kind of keep your arms as close to your body as possible. There are some wonderful tricks you can do with your camera strap. There's this one that one of the Photoshop guys talked about called the death grip, where you kind of wrap your strap around your elbow. And again, it's just a way of keeping the camera as steady as possible.
Have you heard that trick about creating a virtual tripod by hanging a heavy weight at the bottom? Like you put a screw into the tripod mount with a string on it with a heavy weight at the bottom. It gives you some weird stability. It's kind of a funny little thing.
Haven't heard of that one. The one I did hear of is you put a little screw thing on the tripod mount, and then you loop a string against it, and you step on the string.
Oh, yeah, there's one where you make a triangle with it. Yeah, so you have something kind of to pull up on. That one's really freaky.
I know a lot of people who swear by that method, and they take some amazing pictures. So, yeah, again, you know, just anything to keep it steady.
You know what, between you and I, Donald, you know, one of us would trip and fall over trying to do that. I'm not sure. I'd probably beat you to the ground on that.
Yeah. You know, and there's other things you can do. There's, you know, the wonderful, wonderful invention that we call the Gorilla Pod. Those things are awesome. And they now have some really neat ones that have like little magnets at their feet. So you could like stick them on, you know, anything metal. Like, you know, let's say, you know, let's say you're, you know,
the top of your MacBook Pro, maybe?
Yeah, or like, you know, your car hood, you know, if you're taking a picture of like someone in the sunset, you know.
Yeah. I could have used that just last week.
Yeah, the GorillaPods are awesome now. And there's this thing that called a SteadyPod, which is like kind of a less ghetto version of the string tripod. It's, you know, it looks slightly more professional.
Okay.
If you're trying to, if you have a surface that you can use, but it's not necessarily level, like say some rocks or something, get a beanbag. There's these beanbag tripods that, you know, basically, you know, let you put your camera on a normally uneven surface.
I've seen those.
Or better yet, get an old sock and fill it with navy beans or something.
Now again, doesn't this get you to the giant backpack of doom when you're done?
If you're judicious about it, no, like the steady pod that I talked about is about the size of a deck of playing cards, for example.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And there's one other thing that sounds totally silly, but it works, is what's called the bottle cap tripod.
What's that?
It's a bottle cap with a tripod socket on it. And you might think, oh, what's the use of that? You know, it actually gives you enough stability sometimes to pull off the shot. Obviously, you can't really use this for a DSLR, but for point and shoots, this is awesome.
So what does it give you? That would seem to be a very small stand, a bottle cap.
A small stand, yes, but, you know, if you could set it down on somewhere, or...
You must mean a bigger bottle cap, like a Snapple bottle or something, not a Coke bottle?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm picturing a Coke bottle going, that ain't going to help. That's going to make it more unstable.
Right. Well,
so all of these things help you get yourself more stable. Now, do you have a GorillaPod that'll actually hold up your DSLR? Because I've got one, but it's not strong enough.
Yeah, they actually now make GorillaPods that hold, you know, DSLR and even, you know, some respectable size lenses.
Okay. I got one for my iPhone. I got to try that out at Macworld. That'll be fun. Maybe do a little video using that. Might be fun. Strap it on the seat of the guy in front of me. Tell him to lean over so I can see. Donald said it was okay to bug the guy in front of you. All right. So, what about using flash you're in this kind of a scenario?
First of all, you have to check with your venue because a lot of times they've either frown upon it or it's totally not allowed. But if
it's
you can,
tacky at the very least.
Yeah. But if you can, there are some things that'll make your flash pictures less, well, flashy. Obviously, we mentioned before flash exposure compensation. If you've got it, you can dial down the power so you don't have that whole, you know, really bright overexposed face syndrome, you know, the typical bar shot as what we call it.
Right.
You can also, one of the best things you can do is to get an external flash unit, because then you really have a lot of creative control. Instead of having the flash, you know, blasting the person right in their face, you can do you can kind of hold it off to the side at an angle. And, you know, that again helps to soften the light and to create a more pleasing light.
No, I've heard of these before and I've always been too embarrassed to ask. So we'll put this under the dumb question corner question here. How does the flash you're holding in your hand know what to do with the camera? Are they over Bluetooth or IR or what? How is it talking to the camera?
There's several ways of doing it. You can get what's called a sync cord, which is basically a wire that goes from your flash hot shoe onto the flash itself.
Okay. That I understand then.
That's
good.
The cheapest method. It only costs like $10, I think.
And what is that called?
It's called a sync cord.
Okay.
Now, the one that most people use is using the wireless flash trigger. And I believe you're a Nikon shooter, right?
Right.
Well, the good news is that feature is built into your camera body. You go into the menus and you can turn on what's called the remote commander, I believe they call it.
Yes.
And basically what this does is you're correct. It sends an infrared pulse to the flash unit saying, hey, turn on, you know.
So the flash must have to be physically in front of the camera for the camera to be able to see it to send that IR signal.
Actually, no, because the signal, it does a pretty good job of bouncing off walls, people, that sort of thing.
Really?
I don't know how but it works.
That's crazy. I have noticed, I just got one of the little IR flash triggers for Christmas from Steve, and I noticed I kind of had to be in front of the camera to use it. I definitely couldn't be behind the camera.
Hmm.
But that's a little different. That's using the remote to tell the camera to do something as opposed to the other way around.
Right.
This is the camera telling the flash to do something.
Right.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Are those external flashes, are those expensive?
You can get your basic ones for, I think, about $150 to $200.
Ooh, so not cheap.
Not cheap, but, you know, it's, again, if you have to use the flash, it's really a good way of getting, you know, better flash with it, you know.
It's if you're serious about it, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Again, you don't feel like a dork doing this?
No, not at all. I mean, you see all the, you know, all the, you know, Mr. Pro Photographer guys doing it.
Sure. Yeah. But I always feel like a pretender when I act like I'm some fancy pants photographer and then they look at my pictures and go, you take snapshots.
I try not to let that bother me. You know, I take pictures. That's what I do, you know, that's the way I roll.
Right. Well, you got to have your fun.
So finally, the last thing you can do is use a ring flash. And this is one of those flashes that kind of goes around the lens. These are especially great for macro photography, you know, as well as product photography.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So one of the things that one of my friends does is he takes pictures of models, and really he gets some amazing results because, you know, when the light is right around the lens, it just, it's this sort of, these ring flashes are what the fashion photographers use, and it's sort of the wonderful fashion-y look, especially with, you know, you get this what's called catch light, the little glint of light off of a person's eye, and, you know, that's just, you know, the look, TM.
Oh, yeah. I've definitely seen that. In fact, in Tron, didn't they have that lens on the girl the entire time? That one girl always had the white rings in her eyes.
There you go, yeah. So finally, we get to the theater.
The worst of all scenarios, yes. Right?
Unfortunately, this is the situation that kind of tends to separate the men from the boys, if you like the expression.
Or the girls from the women?
Yeah, and you typically have not a very good position. You know, you may be back in row 50 or something, you know.
Sure.
And the lighting is really bad. It's, you know, bright spotlight on the person, you know, with pretty much pitch black around them.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with that is this throws off the image. This throws off the
light meter, right?
Light meters. Yes.
Yeah.
The camera is kind of geared towards wanting to make the scene an average 18% gray. So when it's faced with that situation, you know, a bright person, dark background, it really tends to nastily overexpose the person or something.
Yeah, I've got that picture. Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about.
So in this case, you have to kind of give the light meter a hint. You have to tell it, hey, wait a minute. There's this setting called spot metering or center weighted average. Your camera probably has one, if not both.
Yeah, I've seen that.
It basically says, don't take the entire frame into account. Only take the center portion of it into account. So then you have a better exposure of, you know, the person, you know, assuming you put them in the center of your frame.
Okay. So if you've got the spot metering, you're saying, not the center weight, but spot metering,
right.
go all the way down.
If your camera has spot metering, use it. If not, center weighted average is the next best thing.
Okay, so let me make sure I can put all these pieces together. I want to set my ISO up as high as I can stand. In fact, yes, under these scenario, I'd probably go 1600 because everything else can be garbage anyway.
And then use neat image if you have to.
Oh, you're right. We'll deal with that after the fact. I'm going to have it on, I'm going to put on my big zoom, my 200 millimeter zoom, so that I can get all the way up on the guy's eyebrows because I'm in the 95th row. I'm going to set for spot metering. I'm going to, am I going to mess with my white balance in this situation?
Get it as close as you can.
Okay. So it's probably some sort of fluorescent kind of thing, I would think.
Right.
Let's see. What else have I got to do? I've got to say, I'm going to be on shutter priority at 1/60th.
At least, right.
And then it's going to be Sinbad on stage at Macworld Expo, and he's going to be doing pirouettes, and I'm never going to get him anyway. Oh, wait, I've also got my lens resting on the shoulder of the guy in front of me.
Yeah, now that's you brought up an interesting thing. If the person is moving around a lot, then you'll want to, you know, and you want to freeze the motion, you'll want to, you know, jack up your shutter speed a bit, you know, typically like 1/250th, but you might want to consider not doing that because, you know, showing the motion might be a really cool thing photographically speaking, you know, technique-wise.
Or maybe I just show Steve's video instead.
Yeah, there you go.
That might be the case. Well, this is getting complicated, but I think I'm getting jiggy with it here. I think I'm starting to figure out where to go.
You know, like I said, unfortunately, theater is the most challenging of the three situations I put forth.
So you also wanted to talk a little bit about just why you want a DSLR instead of a point and shoot.
Yes, and for me, it's three things. It's the ISO, you know, being able to dynamically adjust the ISO, and the fact that the digital SLRs have much bigger sensors compared to your typical point and shoot, which is like, you know, the size of, I don't know, like
postage stamp.
Postage stamp, yeah. And the thing with the sensor size is the bigger sensor, the bigger what's called the photosites, the actual little cells that receive light are. Oh. And the bigger those are, the less noise you get.
Okay. Oh, all right. I didn't know that.
Yes. And you know, less noise means you can jack the ISO up higher. And finally, for me, it's the right tool for the right job, being able to change lenses, you know, being able to put on the 70-200 if I'm in a theater situation, or, you know, a good, 50mm or 35mm prime, you know, if I'm in a situation where I can, zoom with my feet.
So, yeah, I do like being able to switch lenses. I find sometimes it's just so relieving to just, when I realize I only have my iPhone, it's like, oh, it's just going to be so much easier, because I'm always changing lenses. I'm the guy you're sitting next to that's really annoying throughout the speech because I keep flipping between lenses because I can't get the right shot.
Yeah. The thing to do with about that, well, the pro photographers, they actually have two camera bodies, one with a wide-angle lens and one with a telephoto. But the other thing you can do is get what's called one of the super zooms that goes, you know, basically like something that goes from 18 to 270 or higher. Hmm. You're not going to get as good of an image quality with those, because those are compromised lenses. You can't get something for nothing. You have to sacrifice something to get a zoom range in that range. But usually the quality trade-off is acceptable, and acceptable considering, you know, the fact that you have that incredible zoom range.
Right. But the more you zoomed up, usually the slower the lens gets, right?
Right. Unfortunately, that's another trade-off. But, if you're out, these make great vacation lenses, because, you know, you're typically out, you know, taking pictures in the daytime, and, you know, then you have enough light so that, you know, shutter speed or aperture isn't much of a concern.
Okay.
But yeah, like, you know, it's like if I'm in a keynote, you know, a theater situation, you know, I'm not going to be changing lenses because, you know, I'm not going to, you know, I'm going to be taking pictures of the people on stage. I'm not going to be taking pictures of, you know, the guy in front of me as well, you know.
Right, right.
So usually, you know, I can put on, you know, based on what situation I'm in, you know, I can put on the lens that kind of best fits, you know, the situation.
Well, I think the one thing I've learned, if nothing else today, is that I'm probably not going to carry my 50mm, which might also be a 35, I'm not sure, that for most situations that I'm going to be in, I'm probably not going to use that. What about when I'm going through the exhibit hall to the booths? There I can zoom with my feet. Would you use that lens, or would you just use something you can still zoom with, like the 28-80 or something like that?
That's a matter of personal choice. I usually use my 18-55 in that case, because, you know, I don't want to have to, like, you know, be that guy who kind of sits in the middle of the aisle so that he can get the best picture.
Right. Right. I think that's probably good advice. So maybe I won't carry that lens. I got to tell you, I'm not exactly sure when I am supposed to use that lens. I said on last week's show, you know, I was all excited about my light box, and I set it all up, and I put my good fast prime lens on there, and I was all excited. And then Bart says, yeah, but you can't get the guy's teeth and his legs in focus at the same time because your depth of field is so shallow. So he made me take it off. I don't know when I'm supposed to use it.
It's a trick. Typically, your prime lenses are best when you have complete control over the situation. You know, you're in... You know, you have your photo studio, or, you know, your room in your house or whatever, where you can position the subject, you know, to your specifications.
I guess so. But even with my light box, I wasn't allowed to use it. So I don't know. My friend of mine says he uses his 50mm lens, same camera, same lens. We bought them together. And he says, oh, yeah, I use mine all the time. It's the only lens I use. And he's like taking pictures of his baby with it. And I don't know. Maybe he's fast on his knees chasing the baby around.
Maybe.
I'm not sure. So any bottom line advice?
Bottom line,
You actually suggest reading the manual, don't you?
Believe it or not, yes. And you know, the thing with that is, you know, be familiar with your camera, the way it operates. I've seen plenty of times when, you know, something cool, we're at a convention, something really cool walks by, and people are fumbling with their cameras trying to figure out what how do I get this setting, you know? Whereas, you know, if you've read the manual, or you know, if you've practiced a lot with your camera, you know, your hands will sort of instinctively go to the correct button to push. You know, it's like the Force, you know, from Star Wars.
Yeah, I think that's probably the best advice. I mean, I can read the manual, and I have spent a lot of time, believe it or not, whether anybody believes me, I have spent a lot of time with the Nikon D40 manual, but it never made any sense to me because I couldn't figure out, okay, I know that if I make the aperture bigger, my depth of field will be shallower. I know that. But when do I do that? And how do I do it? In what circumstance? And what is the right number to put it on? It wasn't until I spent time with Bart where he would say, okay, now is a good time to do this. You know, and that practicing with someone who knows what they're doing is worth its weight in gold. I mean, that made all the difference. Because I intellectually understood bigger aperture means more light, you know, the shutter speed goes up, that kind of, I mean, I intellectually understood that, but I didn't know what number to pick.
Exactly. And practice is the key to that. And, you know, this is one of the wonderful things about digital is that, you know, we can get instantaneous feedback. You know,
take
a picture using a set of settings and you know exactly what it looks like. You don't have to wait, you know, 2 weeks for your film to get back from the processors or whatever.
I can't imagine how hard it would have been to do my lightbox testing where I took 40 photographs and every single one of them was crap.
Yeah.
But the 41st was pretty darn good, you know.
Yes.
But I wouldn't have, and they were all crapped differently. So each one of those batches would have been a separate trip to the darkroom.
Right, and you know, that's the wonderful thing about digital. It's a interactive learning experience.
One thing I got appreciation for too is sometimes it's the mistakes you make that teach you more than when you got lucky and did it right.
Yes.
Yesterday, Katie and I went to the beach, and I thought I had put on my 18-55, or I think it's 18-55 lens. That's what I meant to do because I knew I was going to be doing a lot of landscape kind of stuff because we were going to the beach. But I'd accidentally grabbed my, 80-200, something like that. Mm-hmm. And I got these amazing photographs of Katie, of my bike, of a seagull because I had the shallow depth of field because I had to get away and zoom up that I got these fantastic photos, and I was really happy I made a mistake and I learned something that was a better lens for that situation than I thought I was going to use.
Yeah, it's wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah, mistakes are a good thing sometimes, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of times, you know, some of the greatest discoveries have been made because, I sort of did this kind of the unconventional method, or I did this wrong, you know?
Right, right. I think it was Richard Feynman, Nobel Prize-winning physicist Richard Feynman said the best thing you can hear in the lab is, "Well, that's interesting."
Yes, yes, that's
didn't
right.
See that coming, because that's when science is going to happen. You know, that's when you get the good stuff.
That's the great thing about digital is, you know, we have, especially with DSLRs, you know, you have such a wide variety of lenses and other accessories, and you can try different things, and it doesn't cost over $9,000, you know, to develop your film and stuff.
Right. There's cost of entry, but then after that, it's all free after that, right?
Right. And actually, the one thing I wanted to mention about that is, you know, especially if, you know, it's something that you maybe only want to only do once a year or something, or just a special event, is renting gear actually makes sense. You can rent, you know, really nice lenses for, like, you know, only, you know, like 50, 80 bucks a week, you know?
Yeah, I've seen that. I was in Hawaii and we were... Steve had forgotten the charger for his camcorder, so we found a Photoshop that had one. And while we were in there, this woman came in, and it was so frightening because she didn't have any idea what she was doing, but she was renting this giant lens. I mean, like as long as your arm kind of lens, and it was going to be like $100 for a week. And, you know, it was you know, probably $1,000 lens, but she was able to just use it while she was there and not have to carry it there and back.
Exactly. Yeah.
I don't know what she was going to do with that lens, though, because like she didn't quite understand how to use her camera yet, and she was renting this great lens. But what are you going to do?
But yeah, you know, I just last year started covering anime conventions, and for the theater situation that it described, you really need what's called the photojournalist special, which is the 70-200 f/2.8 lens. Mm. That lens costs like $2,500, but I can rent it for like $80 a week.
Wow, well that's not bad. And then you can find out if that's a lens you like, if you know how to use it. Maybe it's a way to find out too.
Yes, and I remember a couple, many chit-chat across the ponds ago, Bart was talking about how he decided eventually on Nikon. He tried out a Canon and he said, didn't like it. If you're thinking on the fence, thinking about making the move to DSLR, you might want to consider rent. If you don't have a pretty good camera shop in town, that you can try out these things, rent a Canon and a Nikon. It doesn't really cost that much. And then that way you could, have really a lot of sit down time with both and you'll find something that you like,
Yeah, I think that's actually really good advice. I did spend a lot of time picking them up when I picked up the Nikon D40, I went, it just felt right to me. And that doesn't mean it's going to feel right to you.
Right.
It just felt right to me. So exactly. I think that's great advice.
Yeah.
Well, Donald, I really appreciate you coming on the show. You gave us links in the show notes to the photography workshop you gave at Anime Expo 2010. We have
video and everything.
Yeah. It's a great site. And we have anime convention photography. We have a Flickr group for that and your other photography. So we have a whole lot of great links for people to go out and see that Donald does know what he's talking about when you see his photos. That's for sure.
Indeed.
So your main gig is at otakunopodcast.com, not what Katie Floyd continues to say. She calls it, what does she call it? All Taco, No Podcasts. She's mean. Luckily, you have a good sense of humor. But anyway, back to Otaku No Podcast. And I really appreciate you coming on the show, Donald, especially on such short notice. This was fantastic.
Not a problem. This has been fun.
All right. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Take care.
Well, I'm sure you're wondering why I haven't talked about my photos at all from the trip or even mentioned the No Sella Castaways party. Well, it's only because I've run out of time, and I did want you to hear about the conference photography ahead of time because I have some stories about my camera and a train and the concept of a momentum and all kinds of things. Next week, we'll slow down a little bit, but we have more interviews to go and more flavor of the show to talk about. I gotta say, I'm exhausted now, so I'm gonna go lay my little pumpkin head down when I'm done here. Keep your dumb questions and comments coming. Not that your comments are dumb, you know what I mean. Anyway, keep them coming by sending them in to allison@podfeet.com. And be sure to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.